What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of Apologia TV. I'm Jeff Durbin. They call me the Ninja, and that is Luke the Bear what Pearson. Up? And that is Joy the Girl, Timby.
Hello.
And we are on today. First of all, I guess I'll point you first to Apologia Studios, apologiastudios.com, A-P-O-L-O-G-I-A, studios.com. First time I've used that domain name on the television show, because we actually own ApologiaRadio.com and ApologiaStudios.com. And so ApologiaStudios.com is where you guys go to get all of the past radio episodes, over 200 of them. Yes.
That many now?
Over 200 radio episodes.
You know,
yes.
I get asked all the time, people like ask for like certain, when did you say? I'm like, I don't know. They all seem like one episode at this point.
That's right.
Just, like, just search it.
Just blend together. So ApologiaStudios.com, you get all the radio episodes. We've had a bunch of different guests on, scientists, scholars, theologians, pastors. I mean, everyone from Douglas Wilson to Jonathan Sarfati, Creation Ministries International. And we just actually recently finished, if you haven't seen it, an episode on the flat earth myth. Yeah. Right. With Dr. Robert Carter. Yes. And so just tons of stuff there. So go to ApologiaStudios.com. You can also sign up for All Access, where you get every single television show, every single after show, and you get the Apologia Academy, where you can even learn from our guest today, Dr. Mitch Stokes. Dr. Mitchell Stokes, PhD.
Oh.
PhD, right. Y'all. Senior Fellow of Philosophy. He has a PhD in philosophy from the University of Notre Dame. Notre Dame, 2005, an MA in philosophy, University of Notre Dame. Is that the sophisticated way to say it?
That's how they. That's the name of the building.
The Hunchback
in
Notre Dame.
In
there you go.
Yeah. France.
Yes,
but
that guy.
Notre Dame is really what most people call.
Okay.
College
all right.
Here.
Well, he got that in 2003. He has an MA in religion, philosophy of religion from Yale University. Mm. What's up with the big brains in Moscow, Idaho? A lot of big brains in Moscow, Idaho.
Yes.
He additional graduate study in theology because he it just wasn't enough, Luke. It wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. PhD, MA, MA, Yale, Notre Dame. And so he got an additional graduate study in theology, Reformed Theological Seminary, Orlando, Florida, 94 to 99, and MS in mechanical engineering. This is getting to the point of ridiculous. University of Central Florida. And just to throw one in there, he got a BS in mechanical engineering from University of Florida, 92. And this is Dr. Mitchell Stokes. Welcome, Mitch.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. And so we like you, Mitch.
That's great. That's,
yeah.
That makes how many of it? That makes four of you.
Yes, yes.
That's including my mom.
Yeah, your mom. Okay. So we think that you're great. We love the stuff that you've done. And we actually got to run into you and chat a bit when we were in Moscow, Idaho, hanging out and doing some ministry with Doug, Pastor Doug. And we recently saw your rise to fame.
Oh, yeah.
On Netflix. You are in a film done by Nate Wilson, and it's called The River Thief. So let's start talking about that before we get into your new book, How to Be an Atheist. Let's talk about you and The River Thief.
Okay.
So how was that?
That was awkward. It was out of my comfort zone, that's for sure. But I played a police officer.
Yeah.
A good guy, though. I was a good cop.
Yeah, yeah. You were confronting the corrupt police officer.
That's right.
Yes, yes. I enjoyed the film, Mitch. And so that's all. Remember that time, Mitch?
Wait, hey, Johnny Cash's brother was in that. So
yeah.
That was awesome, too.
Awesome.
I watched it twice, and then Luke watched it on the plane on the way back from Moscow recently, and he was like, hey, did you see that guy? Wasn't that like Johnny Cash's bro?
I like your impression of Luke.
I didn't say it like that.
Yeah. You know what's sad is that Luke and I didn't get to sit together on the plane back from Moscow. Or to Moscow.
Well, I'm sure you've made up for it.
Because it was
braiding each other's beards.
He was just using my beard brush.
Yes, I was. We did share the same beard brush. All right, so now that we're moving on past that, Dr. Stokes, tell us about your book, How to Be an Atheist, and why are you, as a Christian, writing a book helping people to become atheists? That seems a bit sinful.
Yeah, that's you're right. Well, actually, before I mention that, I wanted you mentioned something about flat Earth.
Yes.
Are you guys flat earthers?
Dude.
Oh.
What? Are you a denier?
I hope.
Mitch, are you a denier?
I hope that wasn't a serious question.
I just wanted, I thought that would be an interesting conversation.
No. We had a show refuting.
Doug, come on now.
Yeah. Come on now. We're Reformed Baptists, but don't like get a, you know.
No, when they were flying to Moscow, they were like, but did you see the horizon?
Yeah,
no
flat.
Way.
Did you see
no
that there's
way.
No curvature, bro? No, Dr. Stokes, we actually did a show refuting the flat earth myth.
Okay, that's I'm more comfortable now.
Okay, good. Okay.
So let's talk about my sin. The how to be an atheist. So it's basically the name of the book comes from an article that Alvin Plantinga wrote years ago on how to be an anti-realist, where he was refuting anti-realism, and he was saying, look, if you want to be an anti-realist, here's what you got to do, or here's what I think you have to do, and it's not pretty. And I thought that was just a great way of addressing it and getting people's attention. But it's really it's mostly saying, look, if you are an atheist, or if you have, and even not an atheist, if you just tend to have these highly skeptical stance towards all things intellectual, here's what skepticism would look like. And in addition, here's what atheism would look like as well.
Okay. And so that's an interesting thing to talk about before we wrap up this segment is, didn't you study under Alvin Plantinga?
Yes. Yeah. He was one of my dissertation directors. That was really pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I was reading some of the, reviews for your book, and there were quite a few that were like, I'm so mad that I bought this. I thought this was going to help me be a better atheist.
So you no, did. You didn't.
Yeah, no, they're there.
No way.
On Amazon?
For real. Hey. Low ratings, 1-star ratings, because they were this isn't going to help me be a better atheist at all.
Yeah.
So you got a few people to read your
I don't book like the implications, bro. That's awesome. See, that's being...
No, but it really will help them to be a better atheist.
No, it will.
Right.
Give it a chance.
Yeah, just give it a chance, guys. Live it out to its fullest. So what we're going to do is we're going to now go to a commercial break. We're going to come back with Dr. Mitchell Stokes, New St. Andrews College. We're going to talk about his book. The book is called How to Be an Atheist. We're going to actually unpack a few things and discover what that actually means. How to be an atheist. What sort of things would you have to embrace? How would you have to live to embody what it truly means to be an atheist? And so we're going to come right back. We're going to be on with Mitch Stokes, Luke the Bear, Joy the Girl, and myself. Don't forget to go to ApologiaStudios.com to get more. And, of course, thank you to our crew today in the back working behind the scenes to make all this possible. We will be right back right here on Apologia TV. Stay with us. We are back. Welcome back, everybody, to Apologia TV. On today, talking with Dr. Mitchell Stokes with New St. Andrews College. We're talking about his book, How to Be an Atheist. And so, Dr. Stokes, let's get started with the conversation here. When you write this book, obviously, you're trying to dig in deep to what it really means to embrace atheism and this skepticism. And so let's start the conversation. How to be an atheist. What does that mean to you when you write the book?
Yeah, well, part of this, and this came from, I've been wanting to write this book for quite a while. I tend to have a skeptical temperament myself. And so I actually appreciate some of the things that atheists say, or at least I can totally understand them. There's probably a small atheist in my heart that's I'm trying to get rid of, but I certainly understand and appreciate some of the things that where they're coming from in certain cases. And I've struggled with a lot of doubts, and actually it's how I went from engineering into philosophy, was to address those doubts. So I guess I want to say that to preface all of this is it's something that I have struggled with myself, and I've always looked at atheists and thought that they're pulling punches. Well, how about this? They're not so much pulling punches with us, but I think they're pulling punches when it comes to their own worldview. I just think, if I was an atheist, what would I what would I be like? I mean, what would I believe about things like morality? And it certainly would be more hard-nosed than a lot of atheists are now. And so I kind of just let my inner skeptic run with this, my inner skeptic has run for years. But that was what the book was predicated on, not just looking at skepticism from the outside, but also struggling with it myself and knowing what I would have to, at least where I think I would go if I didn't believe in God.
Well, what does that mean when you say pulling punches? They're pulling punches in reference to themselves. Like, what kinds of things do you mean when you say that?
Right. Yeah, that's probably, maybe pulling punches is not the best metaphor. I think what they're doing, though, is they're not, for example, I think they're not taking their views as seriously as they ought to.
Okay.
So let's say, for example, that in a couple of the views, in the book deals with this, so there's a few of the things that they don't take seriously is, I don't think they take their skepticism as seriously as they do. They're very good at being skeptical about other people's worldviews and about other people's beliefs. But I don't think they're as skeptical about their own, particularly when it comes to things like science. I mean, and I'm not a science basher. I think there's lots of truth to science. But when it comes to things like science has shown that there's no God, I think they really overstep their boundaries, and at least in terms of what they have rationally. And I don't think they're skeptical enough. So there's that. And then there's also when it comes to ethics, I think atheism, I just don't think they take atheism as seriously as they do when it comes to ethics. And I think that is probably that in itself is probably the most crucial thing, I think, that I point out in this book.
Well, let's give me a sampling of that. When you say that they're not taking it seriously, taking their atheism seriously in the direction of ethics, like give us a good example of what it means to truly be an atheist in the area of ethics.
Sure. So the thing is, I mean, first it's to, and this is, you can ask me questions as I'm going through this, but let me predicate it on. When we're talking about ethics, we're talking about moral values, the things that we value, the things that we prize, the things that we like. And so you have, when someone says that Hitler was wrong, that's a moral statement, and it's expressing a moral value. All right, so now. So what I do in the book is I start with value. Okay, so what is it to value something? And I point out, or I argue, that value it depends on a valuer. So, taking the example of, well, what makes gold valuable? Well, it's us, and it's what we want to do with it. It's really, you can analyze it into its molecular structure, and it doesn't have any value in and of itself. It's only valuable because we value it. So I try to point out that the value is person dependent. So, and that includes any sort of value whatsoever, aesthetic value, value when it comes to morality. And I make the argument in the book that it applies to all value. So that's the thing right there is okay, so if value, if what's right or wrong depends on whether or not, it's basically depends upon a believing subject, someone who does the valuing.
Okay.
And, so if you're an atheist, who are the valuers? Well, humans are. I mean, that's it. I guess you could probably, and maybe someone like Peter Singer might do this, if apes have enough cognitive capacity to value things, they might be included in the picture as well. But humans tend to be the ones, I mean, humans are the ones who value things. So that being the case, if all value is dependent upon a person, on a human, then morality depends on human beings. That's it. There's no other person to value these things.
Right.
So then once you get to that stage, then you go, okay, which person, which people, which group of people, you know, basically become, and Hume pointed this out. I mean, this was something that, and Hume is kind of the hero of the book.
Okay.
He's one of my heroes in a sense. He has some fantastic arguments, and he really tried to take his skepticism seriously, which is why he's known as a skeptic. But when it came to morality, he pointed this out. He's like, look, apply this current scientific method that, say, Newton has, that just came out in his day, to morality. What sorts of things do you observe? Well, you can't observe whether or not a killing is right or wrong. I mean, you can observe a killing. You can observe when someone, you know, there's a knife, there's a sharp object, and it goes into the heart of another human being. The heart stops working, you know, all of that. You can explain it, describe it as, you know, as far as you want, as far as you feel like it empirically, but you'll never observe whether or not that was right or wrong.
That's right.
And so what you have is, and so what Hume says is, well, okay, well, let's see, where do we find this valuing or this judgment of right or wrong? It's only in our gut. It's and what he calls sentiment. Mm-hmm. It's basically we look at that and go, ugh.
Right.
If it's murder, or, you know, if it's not, we you know, maybe say yay if it's something that we agree. So, but he distilled it down to sentiment, which I just think, first of all, I think and for him, sentiment meant just kind of a feeling. I kind of like that he used sentiment, because we think of sentimentality as kind of this sappiness.
Right.
And I think there is something to that. If you read, and we do this at, you know, for my students, I have them read people like Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins. And so we've just finished reading Harris again. And it's amazing how sentimental,
right,
his writings are.
Dr. Stokes, hang on to that thought. We're going to be right back with Apologia TV. Stay with us, guys. Dr. Mitch Stokes on the other side. And back with Dr. Mitch Stokes right here on Apologia TV. Joy the Girl, Luke the Bear. Here we go. You were just finishing up that last segment, Dr. Stokes, talking about Harris's book and the depth of the sentimentality that was going on there.
Yeah, so like I was saying, it was I think where Hume uses sentiment to mean, have this notion of, well, it just, we feel that something's right or wrong, and that's where ethics is founded or grounded. And but I just noticed how the sentimentality that Harris appeals to, and other atheists too, you know, when you say, well, wait, don't you think that killing unnecessarily is wrong, and we say, well, yeah, of course, totally. But it's amazing. The question isn't so much what we like; it's the question of, well, how does your entire worldview make sense of those feelings? Are they just merely feelings, or is there something behind them? And if there's nothing behind them, then it becomes pretty sappy.
Yes, and at most points completely arbitrary and dependent upon how one particular bag of protoplasm is feeling.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. And it really is. And again, that notion of feeling, we think, you know, someone might be listening and say, come on, it's not feeling. I mean, it's certainly not just my feeling that what Hitler did was wrong. You know, it's objectively wrong. Well, actually, if you really don't have a standard backing up that stands outside of humans, it really is literally a feeling.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. No question about that. And by the way, if you guys are new to this discussion, when Dr. Stokes is talking about Hume, he's talking about David Hume, the really well-known Scottish skeptic who gave everyone angst and difficulty when he talked about the problem of induction. And I think it was Hume that said, like, when he thinks about induction, the problem of induction, he likes to sit into his easy chair and just, like, drink bourbon or something like that and just forget or something like that. Essentially, like, I don't know. I don't have an answer. Pure skepticism. So, all right. Do you guys want to jump in here?
Yeah, I have a question for you. It's related to something we talked about in the first segment. So in the book is obviously why many skeptics aren't skeptical enough. So atheists aren't skeptical enough, but you do touch a little bit on the benefits of skepticism for believers too. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. And here's the thing. I'm all for skepticism. I mean, that's not, so this is definitely a pro skepticism book, but now what I mean by skepticism isn't disbelief in God. That's oftentimes how the term is used. You know, so a skeptic is someone who's either agnostic or atheist, and that's not how I'm using it. I'm using it in terms of this sort of intellectual caution. So a kind of safety first approach to matters intellectual. You know, so I mean, skepticism is very, protects us from all manner of things like used car salesmen. I mean, and by the way, some of my best friends are used car salesmen, so I don't want to be, I don't think that that's a problem, but, you know, you have to, you know, let the buyer beware. That's a kind of skepticism. You're not going to buy just any old, medicinal, some sort of health, something that gives you health benefits allegedly from the internet. You know, I mean, like there's you might want to be a little skeptical about the claims of different treatments. So there, I think there's a really good type of skepticism, and so amen for skepticism. Amen for atheists being skeptical, agnostics being skeptical. That's not my concern. So that's what I mean by skepticism.
Right. The actual definition of it, not like a societal, like you said, like a skeptic is sort of like the definition of that has almost been changed to someone who is an unbeliever.
Right.
Don't believe something, but really skepticism is just like discernment, essentially. Like,
yeah, it really is. And that can be a little disappointing. You know, you start reading the book and you go, wait a second, skepticism really doesn't sound all that exciting in the least. You know, it's just kind of being rational and you know, just not being too enthusiastic one way or another about things and just being careful right. intellectually mm-hmm. and knowing. And I point this out in the book, it's surprising our lack of skepticism and what that can lead to. So for example, I think believers do this and unbelievers do this, and this is a mistake. I mean, and I'm sure I do it as well. So it's sometimes we mistake the strength of our arguments. We think that, okay, we've got this really strong argument, but really what we ought to mean is that we believe this, we hold this position very strongly, or we're loyal to this position. So let me just take belief in God. I'll point to myself. So I'm very loyal to Jesus. I want the gospel to be true. I've done things that, you know, I made sacrifices for that. So I'm very dedicated to Jesus. So therefore I'm also dedicated to things like God exists and the scriptures are reliable and all of that. And but I have to be careful not to think that I've got these knockdown arguments that match my dedication and loyalty. I mean, not that, now that's not to say that I don't have good arguments, and that doesn't mean that I don't have a good rational position, but I really have to be careful to not mistake the loyalty for the strength of arguments.
Mm. Ah.
And so that's and I think part, so, and that's a big part of starting to step back and analyze your own beliefs and start to look at, okay, well, why is it that I believe this, and starting to sort out where the loyalty comes in versus where the reason can, strengthen it.
Dr. Stokes, hang on to that, guys. Stay with us. We're going to go to the after show, guys, at ApologiaStudios.com. We're going to talk more about the Christian worldview, more about this book, and how the biblical worldview is a foundation for mathematics. Powerful stuff on apologetics and philosophy. ApologiaStudios.com. The conversation is going to continue at ApologiaRadio.com. That's where we're going to have our after show. We're going to have more content, more conversation, some really great stuff. You go over there to get it at ApologiaRadio.com by becoming All Access. Go check it out. Welcome to the After Show, guys, with Dr. Mitch Stokes. We're hanging out here for a few more minutes. We're going to talk some more with Pastor Luke Joy and Dr. Stokes. We just finished up the television show, if you saw it, and we finished up. Dr. Stokes, if you could wrap that discussion up for us. You were talking about the depth of, or the courage within, our own commitments, mm-hmm. being on a rock, being committed, but you were talking about that and having to see the difference between the depth of our convictions and whether or not our arguments are good. Is that essentially what you were saying?
Well, actually not so much whether the arguments are good, but whether or not the strength of the arguments match the level of your dedication and loyalty to, in our case, to Jesus.
Yes.
Now, and obviously that goes for other things too, like atheism. I mean, so you have someone like Thomas Nagel and Hitchens, and I mean, when they want atheism to be true. And I think sometimes what they'll do is they'll mistake the strength of their position. Now, Thomas Nagel is a great atheist. He's an example of a sober-minded atheist, and I wish there were more atheists like him. But anyways, but someone like Dawkins or Dennett or Hitchens, they mistake the strength of their arguments they mistake the dedication to their position, their desire for it to be true, with the strength of their arguments, and that just causes all manner of trouble.
It sure does, right. Particularly in Dawkins.
Yeah,
you see that highlighted often.
And that's why you would say they're not skeptical enough. And
right,
even
exactly.
The Christian should be aware of not being skeptical at all,
yeah,
of something just because it sounds good to you and supports what your loyalty is.
Right.
To.
Right. Yeah.
And I think seeing that in ourselves also helps us to see it in others. And it's amazing how it gives you kind of this ability to see through some of the issues and go, analyzing your own worldview is such a powerful way to help you analyze other people's worldviews and vice versa. So I think it's really just important for people to go through some of the, just analyzing what they believe and why.
So I know we only have you for a few more minutes here, but I wanted to share with our partners and faithful listeners and friends, a really powerful, it is potent. What you talk about when you talk about arithmetics, mm-hmm. and the biblical worldview, we say often, Dr. Stokes, that Christ is the very centerpiece of our thinking. We want, the God of the Bible is the principium. He's the source. He's the foundation of all knowledge. And so that we've tried to demonstrate over the years how that works out when it comes to art, when it comes to church, when it comes to our own private lives, to governments, when it comes to culture and society. But this really interesting thing to discuss when we discuss the biblical worldview as the foundation for mathematics. Mm-hmm. You actually did an Apologia Academy on that particular subject, but I'd love for you to give everyone a taste of what do we mean when we talk about the biblical worldview, the God of the Bible being the foundation of mathematics.
Yeah, and that I think this is one of the most difficult. I think we've as Christian educators, this is one of the most difficult things to tackle, and we've had just a difficulty with it because it seems like, well, okay, 2 + 2 = 4. I mean, what's more there to say? You know, I mean,
right.
That's true for atheists, for believers alike, and then we're done. But a big part of that is just the way we've learned mathematics and the way we understand it now is such a truncated view. You know, it's basically, we think of it as recipes for calculation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it is that. I mean, there are lots of ways. I mean, and part of that's in even the reason why that works and why some of the most astounding mathematics being done today, the reason that it works is, I think, and I can't go into this, but it's such a great argument for design. I think it supports design so well, because it really shouldn't work. Math shouldn't work if we were just collections of, you know, we were just hunks of meat. And so it's
right.
Anyways, that's there's one thing, just seeing the design, and the more you know about mathematics and the more you know how it applies to the world, the better you can see that. Yet, I think one of the things that we need to capture is how important mathematics has been to philosophy since the Greeks, and how much that shaped our culture. So today we have we can split culture roughly up into two categories. We have the postmodern view that's skeptical and just cynical about there being any truth whatsoever. You know, you can't know anything, there's no truth. And then you have maybe what we might call a modernist that thinks, no, reason's the way to go, and reason can get us to anything we need. Anything that's knowledge, reason can get us to that.
Yeah.
And they're usually very pro-science. Now, one of the things, and I did this in that class, and I've done it also in elsewhere, but showed how those two categories of people, that those temperaments can be almost directly traced back to discoveries in mathematics of the 1800s and all the way back to the way we've thought about mathematics in the West since ancient Greek times.
Okay.
And it's weird how you can kind of tell the story of philosophy and culture by looking at mathematics. And I think that's one of the things we need to recapture if we're going to, I mean, because think about it. I mean, who here, you know, raise your hand if you, when someone says math, you think, oh, cool, yay. You know, I can't wait to talk about that. Hardly anybody really thinks that. And I think it's because we have this truncated view.
Yeah, no.
I actually like math.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Yeah, my least favorite subject was mathematics. And I think it's because I had a mean old math teacher. I remember the day in ninth grade. I think it was ninth grade.
So really, it's not that you don't like
math. Well, no, I had a math teacher. Like, I remember that. I'll tell you the setting quickly. I was in math class, high school. I think it was ninth grade, maybe 10th grade. But this woman was, she was just mean. She was a mean old lady. And so I remember that she was doing stuff up on the board, and everyone in class was like looking around like with this kind of confused look on their face. Like, wait, what is, I don't know what? And everyone's like whispering, like, what is she talking about? And so I'm the one that thought, I will help the class out. I will ask what everybody's afraid to ask, and that is, what in the world are you doing? And so everyone's like, well, how do you do this? So I said, teacher, can you help us to understand like how you got to that point? Because I think we're a little confused. And she turned around, she's like, well, if you'd stop playing around and pay attention, young man. And she tore into me. And I remember that she turned back around, everyone's like, sorry. And I just threw my pencil up. I was like, I'm done. And so from pretty much ninth grade to 12th grade,
I bet you weren't playing either. You weren't actually playing around. You were paying attention like a good student.
I actually was. Mm-hmm. From ninth grade to 12th grade, I was just like, I'm out. Peace. But now, listen, mm-hmm. Dr. Stokes, all that to get to this point. Once I actually began to embrace the full orbed nature of the biblical worldview and began to see just the depth of just where we can go in terms of discussion, and began to see, you know, men that I really respect writing books from a presuppositional perspective, talking about mathematics and the biblical worldview. I am utterly fascinated by this now. I know you have to go soon here. Give us a blip of something very interesting in terms of the Christian worldview and mathematics. Like, how would this apply daily to think that Jesus is the source of this knowledge, to really understand it and make it beautiful? Give us like a common thing that most of us would be familiar with in mathematics that you need really the triune God of Scripture to make sense of.
That's a tall order.
It is.
How about this? I can tell you in terms of apologetics why knowing the story of mathematics, its philosophical foundations, and knowing how to do mathematics is important.
Sounds good.
If you think so, one of the most fundamental questions of all time is, why is there something rather than nothing? And that sounds ridiculous, but it's, well, why is there a universe? And rather than no universe at all. And just recently, atheists like Stephen Hawking and Lawrence Krauss have come forward saying, look, we finally answered that question. You don't need a God to account for the existence of the universe. And here's why. Current physics tells us that you can get something from nothing. And how they do this is they point to either something like quantum theory / relativity, so our two main theories of physics, or a very new theory that's still not yet a full-blown theory, string theory. Mm. Now, it's easy to think like, okay, well, wow, that sounds really technical. If the math says that we're, you know, if they're saying the math says that you can get something from nothing, and math has done all of these great things throughout history, then that seems to be the credentials of that claim are pretty high. So all of a sudden, the playing field or the battlefield becomes the area of mathematics. String theory, for example, is purely, I mean, right now it's just purely mathematics. Quantum theory and general relativity are largely mathematical theories and have been empirically confirmed in all manner of ways. So it behooves us to go, okay, well, we better know something about mathematics and is it even possible for mathematics to do that no matter what the details are?
Right.
And so you don't have to know all the details of string theory in order to maybe know that that claim is not legitimate.
Yeah.
Mm. But it does require some knowledge of the limitations of mathematics, the abilities of mathematics, and all of that. So I think it's absolutely critical, because you have Dawkins, for example, saying, you know what, this book by Lawrence Krauss, who says you can get something from nothing, you don't need a God, this might turn out to be as important a book as Origin of Species.
Interesting. Let me ask a question on this just quickly, and we'll wrap up here, Dr. Stokes. What would be some good resources, or what's a good book that you would recommend, other than obviously the one that we're talking about today, your new book, on the issue of mathematics and Christianity, the Christian worldview, and mathematics?
You know what? That's actually this, and this is an issue that we don't have. A lot of the stuff that I've learned, I've had to glean from all these different sources. So it's taken a lot of research to do this, and so I don't think that there has been.
Then you need to write one.
Right. Well, I just finished a calculus textbook that goes into all of this. And this sounds really self-serving. I probably shouldn't
do it. Do it, Dr. Stokes.
Okay, so there's
do it.
I wrote two biographies, one on Newton and one on Galileo, that goes into some of the background even going back to ancient Greece, of how mathematics has been central to philosophy and how it gets into religion as well. So those are, anyways, those are two books. So I am trying to, there may be something out there. I haven't seen it and I've been looking.
So how do you feel about Vern Poitras, his book on mathematics, Redeeming Mathematics?
That might be a good place to begin. He's got a strong, I think he might even have a mathematics PhD from Harvard. So he's just a great godly man, got good stuff on hermeneutics. So yeah, he would be a good place to start. I think we can probably move the ball down the field from that, but yeah, definitely start with that.
Got it. All right, Dr. Stokes, you've been amazing today, brother. Where can people go to get your book?
Amazon. Let's do that.
Amazon.com. How to Be an Atheist by Dr. Mitchell Stokes, M-A-T-H-D, B-S, Ph-D. Right?
Sure.
Yeah?
We'll go with
it. Did I get all those together?
We'll go with it.
Put the string on the end of the name.
Just add one of everything.
Just say, Dr. Mitch Stokes, Big Brain. Check out the Big Brain on Mitch. Like, that's a good tagline.
Before we end, we have like 2 more minutes left. I want to read that review
Okay.
of his book.
Yes.
Okay, so it's titled 1 Star, and so, of course, you can imagine he gave it 1 star. I am rewriting my review. I was taken in by the title and thought this was an atheist book. It's not. It's written by a Christian apologist, and the book is printed by a church group. It soft soaps the real achievements of science and wants to bring God back into the picture. I tossed it in the garbage where a book like this belongs. Don't mind being out of the money. Just as long as I can write a review, it will be well worth it. Thanks for nothing, Mitch Stokes. With ambiguous titles, you got me. But just like the election, I won't be giving you a good review, and I won't be voting for Trump.
Oh, that was an interesting review. Wow, that's amazing.
Thanks for nothing, Mitch Stokes.
Right.
I get that a lot. Thanks for nothing.
Yeah. So based upon that review, you know it's good. So make sure you pick it up, guys.
Right.
All right, Dr. Stokes, thank you, brother. Hope to have you on again sometime, okay?
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being on. All right, everybody. Thank you guys for watching Apologia TV and Apologia's After Show. Wanted, of course, to end the show telling all of you who are watching this right now, thank you. Thank you for your consistent prayers, love, your support for us. Thank you for every month giving to the work of Apologia Church, for being a part of this whole entire thing with us. Everything that happens here, a video on evangelism, on the street evangelism, stuff on abortion, everything that you see we put out, whether it's on the site that you're on or whether it's on YouTube, wherever it's at, it all is made possible through your support and giving. And so we are all very, very grateful for all that you guys do. And for those of you guys that have been with us since the very, very beginning of this, before we even had an episode to drop, and you've been with us since the beginning, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you so much. I mean, it means so much to us. So we're grateful. And that's Pastor Luke.
Peace out.
That's Joy the Girl.
Yeah.
And you know who I am. Everyone knows. Ninja, right? I mean, right? Am I right or am I right?
Everyone.
Am I right? The ninja. Yeah. And of course, thank you to Gabe. Thank you to Carmen. Thank you to our team in the back, Marcus King Ginger, for all that you guys are doing. So we'll catch you guys next time on Apologia TV.